I will now pass it over to Jennifer Hanna, who will open today's call.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Jennifer Hanna, the Deputy Director of ASPR's National Healthcare Preparedness Programs Branch. And it's my pleasure to be with all of you today to connect on a variety of topics related to the management of your cooperative agreement and the ongoing COVID-19 response. Before I hand it over to our first presenter, I would like to provide a brief overview of what we will cover today. Next slide, please. First, I will spotlight a new resource recently posted to our ASPR Healthcare Readiness Programs website. Next, we will hear from Megan Traber, ICF Tracy Program Director, who will provide an overview of the crisis standards of care and patient surge management resources now available on or coming soon to ASPR Tracy's website. Afterwards, Kate Gorbeck of NHPP Branch's Data and Evaluation Support Team will share some guidance on how to report end-of-year healthcare coalition member organization details. Then Lauren Egbert of the NHPP Branch's Data and Evaluation Support Team will share updates on the medical response and surge exercise, or MERCY, which is formerly known as the Coalition or Hospital Surge Test, or CST and HST. Finally, we will hear from representatives from HHS's Office for Civil Rights, who will discuss health equity considerations related to crisis standards of care, planning, and implementation. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. So as stated, I wanted to begin today's webinar by sharing an ASPR healthcare readiness update. And here is a new release of our ASPR Preparedness and Response Capabilities Fact Sheet. The ASPR Preparedness and Response Capabilities Fact Sheet is now published on PHE.gov. This fact sheet describes the high-level objectives that the healthcare delivery system and healthcare coalitions, including its core members, should undertake to prepare for, respond to, and recover from emergencies. To access this fact sheet and view the full 2017 through 2022 healthcare preparedness and response capabilities, please visit the ASPR Healthcare Readiness Programs webpage, select the Performance Measures, Reports, and Guidance tile, and navigate to Other Guidance and Report section. And a member of our team will drop this direct link to the resources in the chat shortly. I will now pass it over to Megan Traber to share information on some new or upcoming ASPR Tracy resources. Megan?
Thanks, Jennifer. Go ahead and move to the next slide. So as Jennifer said, we did want to highlight some new Tracy resources that we've released since the last time we spoke, highlighting a number of them that would be particularly helpful for meeting FOA requirements, including the Healthcare Coalition Radiation Emergency Surge Annex template. This is to write the annex, the plan that is the annex to your overall response plan. And along with that radiation surge annex template, we also updated our radiation and nuclear topic collection. So that's very helpful for the meeting those FOA requirements. We've also continued to update our patient surge and scarce resources and crisis standards of care resources with lessons learned from COVID-19. So those are updated. We've also updated our tip sheet on monoclonal antibody therapy for COVID-19 based again on feedback and information that we've gathered from others implementing these infusion centers and this kind of operation nationwide. And then we also have a number of technical assistance request responses. So many of you know that ASPR Tracy is open to receive technical assistance requests all day long. And so when we do get those requests, if they are the type of request that generates a written response, we redact it with the requester's information, but we post all of those answers because we firmly believe that just because you haven't asked the question doesn't mean you have don't have the question. So we post all of that information so that you can access it. So we've just highlighted a few of our recent technical assistance responses that we've developed on 1135 waivers, on mock resource assessments, mock being the medical operations coordination center, or you know, it's that's a specific kind of operation, patient load balancing, where MOC is a solution. So we did a resource assessment, exercise requirements for intermediate care facilities for individuals with intellectual disabilities, pediatric surge resources for COVID-19. We know that that is an issue facing most, if not many, if not most of you. And then also, we're able to provide some sample physician orders for monoclonal antibody infusion treatment for where you're using standing orders. We also encourage you to take a look at the Express messages that we sent. These are our e-newsletter. We sent two in August. They are hyperlinked here, but you can also find them on our website in our new resources. And then we do have a series of presentations that are geared towards pediatric lessons learned from COVID-19. And they're focusing on pediatric mental health and the issues that have arisen since COVID-19. And it's a series, it's one of our speaker series. So there's a number of presentations that cover different topics. And we did these in partnership with RAPM, one of the ASPR pediatric centers of excellence. So next slide. And so we are working on a number of resources, as always, when we identify areas where we think we can contribute some resources, we work on developing them. So we, as I mentioned, we just released the radiation surge annex template. You are also required to then exercise it. So we are developing the radiation emergency surge annex tabletop toolkit that should be released relatively soon, the next couple of weeks. We are developing a tip sheet on concerns and opportunities for healthcare leadership as a result of COVID-19. What are the things that we are hearing that are keeping up your executives, your healthcare executives, keep them up at night? The effect of COVID-19 on healthcare incident command systems. Hospital and healthcare facility incident command systems have now been stood up for longer than they ever have before. And so that has caused we have a lot of lessons learned about managing incident command in your facilities, but also lots of lessons learned about things that are now maybe not part of incident command anymore. They've been moved into just daily operations. There are things that have been done so long and have improved the process of your day-to-day operations that they're ingrained in your new work. Updated active shooter and explosive topic collections. We are continuing to work on the HCC COVID-19 engagement assessment project. This is a long-term project that we've been doing since February on healthcare coalition engagement during COVID-19. We will have that information and report and next steps available within the coming weeks. And our upcoming exchange issue, which is our newsletter on the impact of civil unrest and community violence on healthcare. We are currently working on compiling really, really impactful lessons from the field on how this is affecting healthcare. Working on some resources on healthcare resiliency and climate change, and we'll be rounding out the surge annexes with completing a chemical emergency surge annex template. And then we're working on a number of upcoming presentations on blood supply and COVID-19, poison control centers, which have even more recently become in the limelight. They're in the spotlight now. And the impact of COVID-19 on women in healthcare, that speaker's presentation will be coming out too. So if they're happy to take any questions, if you have any, or certainly you can reach out to the Assistance Center at any time. Anybody have any questions? Okay. Hearing none, I am turning this over to Kate.
Hello, everyone. It's good to see a lot of familiar faces. I'm going to go ahead and share my screen. So I'm going to talk about the end of year reporting in PERFORMS and how we're collecting that end of year data. So I went ahead and opened up a random state in PERFORMS. I'm not going to share necessarily. So I see that we have, so when you go into PERFORMS, you'll see this list of discrepancies here. These are all the things that need to be answered in order to submit the form. One piece of trouble we're running into is with the organizations. So an update is that we will not be collecting the organizations through PERFORMS this year. We will be collecting through an Excel template. So in order to submit the rest of your data through Performs, you might see a lot of errors. There's no answer for this. So what you would do to bypass these Performs discrepancies, you can go to Form 1.2 HCC member organization details. You can delete all the member organizations here, except for one. It'll always ask for one. Alternatively, you could associate and just get rid of the errors, just associate an HCC over here in this first column. This workaround will allow you to submit the end of year performance measures module at your earliest convenience while still keeping the reporting of the HCC member organizations through the Excel template. So I hope that makes sense. The whole goal is to just bypass the errors that you'll see on the homepage here so that you can still submit. We won't be asking for this information twice. We're only asking for it through Excel. So I can go ahead and share this. You should have received this in your email from the Sharper mailbox. That's sharper@hhs.gov. Each of these is individual. It is tailored to each recipient. So here I made this demo example here. These are the instructions. It's pretty straightforward. We pre-populated all of the member organizations that we know here. The whole goal is to make this as easy as possible, reduce the burden here and allow for easier editing of information. So as you can see, we put in all the information that we have, including addresses, if you keep scrolling to the right. If there's any information we need, it will be highlighted in yellow. So here the HCC has not been assigned, so we just need to know which HCC these organizations belong to. If an organization belongs to more than one HCC, we would just ask that you put a semicolon and then type the name of the second right next to it, or put in the next column as well. Either way, we'll know to associate more than one HCC, only in the case that there's more than one HCC associated to one organization. If you want to add more organizations, you can scroll to the very bottom and just add in the information at the end. So you'll add the name of the HCC, the name of the organization. The type of organization is a drop-down menu, so you can select the type. If you do select other, this year we are asking for a little bit more information. Just a little bit of a category to go with it. And then address, you only need to provide address for the core member organizations. That's acute care hospitals, public health agencies, EMS, and emergency management agencies. Other than that, you don't need to provide any addresses. The core member organizations do have that designation next to them in the drop-down menu already. And then my last point, I'm gonna go ahead and stop sharing here, or I'll just go back to the instructions. The budget reporting and Performs has changed to help with the burden. The budget data will only be required at the object class level. So for financial assistance, personnel, and contractual. If you have any questions, please reach out to Sipper via the Sharper mailbox. But I can go ahead and open it up right now to any questions that I could answer. Just here, if anybody wants to come off mute or drop any questions in the chat, please feel free.
Okay, and it does look like we had a couple questions come in. One of them is from Valerie. Can you repeat what you said about deleting all organizations except for one?
Sure, yep. So that is one way to bypass those Performs discrepancies. You can delete all of your member organizations except for one, and then associate that one organization with a coalition. That will get rid of all of the errors. Alternatively, you can just associate HCCs to each organization that has an error next to it. Again, the goal is just to clear out those errors. We're still working with our partners at Performs to bypass that. If there is an update, we will let you know as soon as possible. I see another question from the chat here. Who is the email from? I will drop the email address in the chat as well. So that's who you should have gotten the email from. If you haven't received the email with that template, please reach out to that email or me directly, and or your project officer. Any of those avenues, we will get to those templates as soon as possible.
Great. And then I think I did see one other question, Kate, or a comment from John that he had already uploaded all of the HTC data into Performs prior to the guidance being sent out to submit data via Excel. Do you have any suggestions on next steps there?
Yes, so everything else, so all HCC information and budget and performance measures, all of those are still being collected in Performs. So that's good to keep that there. Just that it's only the member organizations that are being collected via Excel. We pre-populated that information based on the Performs submissions before. So hopefully there won't be many changes. Just making sure that we've all crossed our T's and dotted our I's. And again, hopefully because it's in Excel, it'll be much easier to edit. You don't have to go one by one. So I hope that helps.
Great. There's another question regarding what was in tab 2.1.
Yes, let me go ahead and share my screen again. Tab 2.1 is the member organization details. So it lists out all of the member organizations of that recipient sorted by the HCC, as you can see. So you can either leave this alone, you can just fill in what you need to, just associate the HCC where you need to in order to get those errors to go away on the summary page, to get some of these errors to go away so you can submit. Or you could delete all of the organizations here except for one, just to bypass the system. For more information about filling in the performance measures in Performs, there is a training webinar recording and a guidance document in the Performs library.
Great, thanks, Kate. Looks like we also received a question from Jessica about for those organizations that have already updated Performs, can they download the data file from Performs and then match the formatting from the Sharper email?
Great question. I don't see a way in order to download on this tab. So that's unfortunate. There are some tabs that you can export to Excel directly from Performs. I don't think this is one of those tabs. Right. I know for sure you can copy paste. I know that's kind of the MacGyver way to go about this, but you can copy this and then paste contents into Excel. So that could be a workaround if you're trying to do a direct comparison from Performs to the Excel template sent out. Again, the template sent out is based off of Performs submissions in the past. So there really shouldn't be too many discrepancies unless you've made changes starting on the date that Performs opened, which was, just double checking my calendar here, Monday, August 2nd. So if you did make those changes since Monday, August 2nd, those won't be reflected in the templates yet. But then again, you can copy paste and compare files that way.
All right. Great, thanks, Kate. I think in the interest of time, we have to move on to our next speaker, but would love to come back if we have extra time at the end of the webinar to answer any additional questions about this.
Oh, actually, I'm so sorry. You can download your list of recipients from over here on the reports tab. Oh, sorry, I paused sharing. Over here on the reports tab, you can download your list of organizations, and you can export that to Excel to then compare. It is required to fill in the Excel template from the Sharper mailbox, just because we have identified areas that we need to fill in some gaps. So sorry, Maria, I'll go ahead and stop there.
No worries, it sounds good. Thanks for clarifying that. All right, well then I will pass it over to Lauren Eckert.
Thank you very much. Hi, everybody. Thanks for being here today, and thanks for your patience as NHPP has been developing and pilot testing the medical response and surge exercise, or the MRSE as we're calling it. And that's the new exercise that's replacing the previous coalition surge test and hospital surge test starting in this budget period. So as I mentioned, we are currently pilot testing the MRSE, and we expect that the final and full exercise will be released in October. You're going to see additional updates and receive additional information in advance of October so that you're aware of the exact date of release and you're able to access upcoming webinars that will orient you to the MRSE and to the tools that are going to support that exercise. So please, you know, stay tuned with your bulletin for additional updates on the MRSE. But early on, we wanted to share some information with you, especially about the major changes in the exercise between the MRSE and the previous CST-HST exercises. So as we said, as the exercise is rolled out, we're going to be offering sessions to orient you and orient coalitions to the new exercise. But this is just a high-level overview to give a little bit of information as we're pilot testing and everything is in its draft form. So first, I just want to acknowledge the large team that's been responsible for developing this exercise. The core team has been led by staff from the National Healthcare Preparedness Programs branch, including several of the field project officers that you know. It's included ASPR's evaluation branch, longstanding program partners at Deloitte and Griffin Scientific, and then a range of subject matter experts have also contributed to the exercise and the development of the exercise, including ASPR's exercise branch. ASPR Tracy has contributed. Hospital associations have provided feedback. The Office of EMS within the Department of Transportation. And of course, we're receiving feedback and support from the healthcare coalitions that are currently piloting the exercise. And so all of those folks have contributed to the exercise as it stands in its draft format today. I think we can move to the next slide now. This is to highlight some of the most significant changes of the exercise. The team has really taken the approach of trying to create a much more flexible and customizable exercise. So it allows healthcare coalitions to really create a surge scenario that tests the things that they know that they need to test. And while there is additional flexibility, that creates additional responsibilities for HCCs to plan their exercise scenario in advance of the exercise. And there are tools provided that will allow healthcare coalitions to plan their particular surge exercise that they'll conduct. Let's see. So basically what that means is that healthcare coalitions don't just have to test a structured evacuation scenario anymore. Your healthcare coalitions can test whatever they know they need to test from their HVAs or their response planning, any improvement planning that they've done in the past or after action reports that have, you know, highlighted areas in which additional testing and improvement would be helpful. The HCC will really pick the exercise that's right for them. And that also allows flexibilities for healthcare coalitions to meet other exercise requirements if they plan their surge scenario that way. So it allows the exercise play to really also be structured around their own response plan and hopefully be a little bit more faithful to the way that the coalition would actually respond in any of these surge scenarios. The team has also really tried to expand engagement of other members of the coalition during this exercise. So there's a greater role for EMS, for example, in the exercise. And additionally, the exercise is now going to use the same structure for all coalitions, rather than that differentiated CST and HST exercise in previous years. The final thing I'm going to highlight is that the 90-minute limit has been removed. So NHPP has heard from your HCCs that it really creates a false limitation. It isn't helpful for them to test their medical surge capability. And so NHPP has done away with that requirement for this exercise. All right, we can move to the next slide now. All right, in the Mercy, the use of real-world events is still perfectly suitable to fulfill the exercise requirement in a given budget period. And the criteria for using a real-world event are outlined here. And so, you know, we're really asking that healthcare coalitions use their judgment and try to identify if the real-world event that they have in mind meets these criteria in order for them to be able to use that real-world event to satisfy their exercise requirement. And the ones that I would flag here as the most important are, you know, that the real-world surge incident has like a pretty discrete beginning and end, right? So you know when that surge begins and you know when that surge ends, and there are kind of bookends that allow you to begin and end the exercise. I think that's a very important criterion. Another one to highlight is that the healthcare coalition must be able to respond to the performance measures that are collected through the Mercy. And those are all highlighted in the tools. And it will be, you know, the healthcare coalitions will be able to see what data they would need to provide from that real world exercise to be able to answer those Mercy performance measures. And additionally, the healthcare coalition must hold an after action review and do improvement planning. And so, you know, certainly we expect that some healthcare coalitions are going to have questions. And as the Mercy is rolled out, we will ask healthcare coalitions and recipients to engage with your field project officer when, you know, you could use a little extra support thinking through whether or not your real world event is suitable to use for the exercise. All right, let's go to the next slide. We'll do this at a very high level because you're going to get a lot more information about this as the exercise is finalized. But there are really three tools that are going to support the exercise. The first is a situation manual, and that's going to be the core document that helps all the participants of the exercise walk through all of the crucial exercise actions. There's an exercise planning and evaluation tool, and that's an Excel-based tool. That will, again, just like the situation manual, guide folks through conducting the whole exercise. And it will also be one place that all exercise data can be recorded and documented. So there isn't the need to kind of document information in a whole bunch of other places and then calculate your performance measures. This tool is going to collect all your data, and then it will populate the performance measures. It will populate the performance measures for you using the data that are entered by the coalition during the exercise. And then there's an evaluation plan that walks the exercise evaluator through collecting those data and that information during the exercise. And it also gives a really detailed performance measure implementation guidance. So you're able to really see for each of your performance measures, what is the operational intent of those performance measures? And what is, you know, for each of the performance measures, what's the calculation? What's the denominator? What's the numerator? And really feel that folks understand those performance measures in detail. And we have one more piece of info to share, and we can open it up for some questions. All right, so this is a very high level overview of the exercise. The exercise is really going to happen in three phases. And that first phase is different from the CST-HST. This is phase one, which is the plan and scope exercise. And it's different because this is where the Healthcare Coalition is going to really organize their own unique medical surge scenario. You're going to, you know, gather exercise inputs from your HVA, from your surge estimator tool, other member requirements, and sit down together and plan the surge scenario. And then in phase two is when the exercise will actually be conducted. And in phase three, you'll have the after action review and improvement planning based on the outputs of the after action review. Every phase of the exercise is supported by information in your in the situation manual, as well as all of the steps, as well as all of the data collection from the beginning of phase one till the end of phase three, is going to be collected in that exercise planning and evaluation tool. So there's one place to go through the full exercise and to input all of the associated data. All right, great. Well, I'm going to pause there. And I think we have maybe 1 or 2 minutes if anybody has any questions that they'd like to submit before I hand it over to our colleague, Scott DeFlito.
If there's any questions yet. I'm not sure if someone's going to come off of mute to ask a question.
And if no one has questions at this time, that's okay too, because there will be many, many opportunities for additional learning and additional questions about the MRSE. This is really just a primer. Okay, wonderful. Well, seeing no questions, I will hand it over to Scott DeFlito. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Lauren. Good day, everybody. My name is Scott DeFlito. I'm a senior public health advisor for the National Healthcare Preparedness Programs branch here in Asper. And just as a couple of quick reminders before moving into our next presentation, the Crisis Standards of Care CONOPS requirement has been extended to the end of this budget period. Asper wanted to provide additional time to make sure recipients are addressing specifically non-discrimination issues. Additionally, recipients must conduct an annual exercise that specifically addresses the needs of people with disabilities and other high at-risk individuals or populations. And HPP recipients should consider the access and functional needs of at-risk individuals and engage these populations as they plan HCC-based exercises. During the past two budget periods, ASPR provided flexibility to allow recipients to use the COVID-19 response to meet the requirement if there's verification of inclusion of vulnerable populations based on COVID-19 parameters set by the CDC. And on this note, today we have an opportunity to engage with the HHS Office of Civil Rights, specifically on issues of non-discrimination and health equity in crisis standards of care. So I'd like to introduce Robin Frobozy, the Acting Director and Principal Deputy for the Office of Civil Rights. Thanks to you and your team for joining us today.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you so much for inviting us to join you today. And thank you for the great collaboration that we have had with you, your team, all of ASPR throughout COVID and in terms of overall preparedness and planning. And I also do want to thank all of the HPP participants, because I really understand what is on your shoulders and in your hearts every day as you're both responding to the pandemic and its many twists and turns, but also thinking ahead about lessons learned, best practices, and the next potential emergency situation that might come. I am joined by two of my very key colleagues from the Office for Civil Rights, who also will be joining in on this presentation. I'd like to introduce them at the outset: Molly Bergdorf, who is a senior civil rights analyst. If you could wave, Molly, I see you there. And at least on my screen right below you is Ari Niem, who is a consultant contractor who has been invaluable to OCR throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, and particularly around crisis standards of care. So we'd like to save some time at the end for questions. Thank you to those who drafted questions ahead of time. And we have tried to weave them into our presentation. But if we could advance through the slides, let's see the next one that may come up. There we go. And if we could go to the first slide, which is for those of us, for those of you who may not be familiar with our office, it is the Office for Civil Rights. The acronym is OCR. We are part of the Secretary's office, and we are actually a law enforcement agency, and also have a regulatory policy outreach technical assistance role. We do enforce a number of civil rights laws, and those civil rights laws are applicable really to all of you. It's anyone who receives funding from HHS, but also HHS programs, as well as any public entity. We are located in Washington, D.C. As a matter of fact, I'm directly one floor below the secretary and in our main office in Washington, D.C. And we have regional offices throughout the country. On the next slide, you'll just see the range of topics that we covered. So that will be the major laws that we enforce. And as you can see, it's very broad ranging in terms of civil rights. It covers race, color, national origin, disability, age, sex, non-discrimination. And we have a very important role under the Affordable Care Act, because there is a non-discrimination provision known as Section 1557, that prohibits discrimination on all of the bases that are in the bullets above in health programs and activities, and it includes insurance plans. We also, in addition to our civil rights responsibilities, are the law enforcement agency and regulatory agency for HIPAA privacy, security, and breaches. The next slide really gets to the heart of what we're talking about today, which is COVID-19 and health equity. And we do know from firsthand experience, as the pandemic unfolded, just the tragic, disproportionate impact that it had on communities of color and other vulnerable populations, including individuals with disabilities and older adults. And so health equity has been a principle throughout the government's response. It was formalized by President Biden on his first full day in office on January 21st, when he issued the executive order on ensuring an equitable pandemic response and recovery. And there's a hyperlink to that executive order right in this PowerPoint. And it also was a cornerstone of the entirety of the COVID response national strategy that this administration also has issued. So this executive order does address the disproportionate and severe impact of COVID-19 on communities of color and other populations, as I mentioned. And the president notes that it's really impossible to change the course of the pandemic without tackling it in the hardest hardest-hit communities and some of the underlying issues. So the executive order does direct a government-wide effort to address health equity. HHS, including ASPR, is at the lead of that effort. And there also is this HHS COVID-19 Health Equity Task Force. So moving on to the next slide. You may wonder why the Office for Civil Rights is talking about the broader principles of equity. And that's because equity, of course, starts with non-discrimination. And none of us intend to actively, intentionally discriminate against individuals. But it oftentimes, and we certainly found this in the COVID-19 response, would be that there would be policies and practices that unintentionally discriminated against certain communities and in civil rights parlance had what we call a disparate impact. So right from the get-go, in March of 2020, at the very first announcement from the Secretary of a public health emergency in COVID, we did make the announcement that during public emergencies, including the COVID-19 pandemic, that laws prohibiting discrimination remain in effect. And we then stood up a COVID-19 civil rights webpage. We also have a separate COVID-19 HIPAA webpage because we've been active in that area as well. And each of them contain multiple guidance documents and technical assistance in terms of the civil rights guidance. It really covers a wide variety of areas from accessibility to vaccinations. We just very recently, in conjunction with the Department of Justice, issued guidance on long COVID, which is also a growing phenomenon. It covers hospital visitations and many other topics, including crisis standards of care. So on the next slide, we are turning to the principle that we would like to focus on during this particular presentation, and that's crisis standards of care. I know that we all had fervently hoped that states invoking their crisis standards of care was long past. We saw yesterday that Idaho had to invoke its crisis standards of care. And there is word that there are a number of other states that tragically are at the cusp of issuing their crisis standards of care. So at the beginning of the pandemic, when lots of crisis standards of care were in place, our office actually received a lot of complaints from stakeholders, from consumer coalitions, from advocacy groups, really concerned about their state's crisis standards of care. So, sorry, can everyone hear me okay? Hopefully, all right. So we received a number of complaints about crisis standards of care, and we realized that we needed to address these complaints, but also address the topic of crisis standards of care in a way that would be very helpful to states, provide technical assistance, and also to work with states to voluntarily revise their crisis standards of care to eliminate this inadvertent discrimination that could be built in one way or the other. And you see on this slide, hyperlinked, we have examples of 9 different situations, states, hospitals, and regions, then, and also an HHS component, the Indian Health Service, where we worked side by side with the states to incorporate really best practices of how to apply basic civil rights principles. On the next slide, you'll see that we right now, and so this is very timely, are working on a civil rights toolkit that will bring together all of the work that we have been doing, the lessons that we have learned in working with states and hospitals and various regions, and to provide this toolkit for as states are looking at their crisis standards of care. Now, interestingly enough, at the beginning of COVID, we were seeing some very outdated crisis standards of care, which actually had categorical exclusions and by that I mean that certain groups of individuals, either by age or type of disability, would just not be automatically not be considered for scarce resources that were available. So we worked with some states to do early course correct on that, got the word out about categorical exclusions. And as we went on working through our complaints and states reaching out to us for technical assistance, both the types of situations and our thinking about the best way to apply civil rights principles really evolved over time. But they do focus around 2 very key concepts. And the very first one is that medical care, of course, should never be denied based on stereotypes, assessments of quality of life, or judgment about a person's relative worth, or the presence or absence of disabilities or age or other protected characteristics. And the second really key principle is that decisions whether an individual is a candidate for treatment or for scarce resources really do have to be based on the best available objective medical evidence. So the two go hand in hand. On the next slide, we are turning to a specific case example, which is really our most recent work with the state on crisis standards of care. And Ari Meehan, who was essential in this case resolution, is going to walk you through it so that you can see the application of some of the principles that I've been talking about.
Thank you so much, Robin Sue. You know, as you mentioned, our most recent early case resolution was with the state of Arizona, which made a series of voluntary changes in the context of the ECR process. ECR is a non-adversarial process where covered entities work with OCR to resolve a complaint in a collaborative fashion. We provided Arizona with technical assistance, leading to the adoption of the following best practices, many of which are also reflected within OCR's other ECRs on crisis standards of care. This is, you know, really only the most recent, the number we've done, and we now have a series of standard best practices we look for in CSC policies when complaints or technical assistance requests are brought to us. So Arizona made the following changes within their CSC. First, they removed language that made use of long-term survival as an allocation factor. Arizona's new CSC now focuses on likelihood of short-term survival to hospital discharge. Arizona also, next slide, please, avoids the use of categorical exclusions, incorporating instead Individualized assessment based on the best available objective medical evidence. Arizona also avoids the use of resource intensity and duration of need as a criteria for the allocation or reallocation of scarce medical resources. This protects patients who require additional treatment resources due to their age or disability from being given a lower priority to receive life-saving care due to those needs. Arizona incorporated reasonable modifications to the use of clinical instruments for assessing likelihood of short-term survival when necessary for accurate use with patients with underlying disabilities. And I want to highlight this because it responds to a question we received from one of you during the registration process, which asked specifically about prognostic scoring instruments, like the sequential organ failure assessment, the modified sequential organ failure assessment, or the PELOD-2. And this is really an example that would apply to the SOFA, MSOFA, PELOD-2, and other scoring instruments, where you have an instrument used to assess likelihood of short-term mortality risk that may need modifications when being used with people with disabilities. For example, the SOFA incorporates the Glasgow Coma Scale, which gives patients an elevated score and thus an elevated risk of mortality when they have difficulty with speech or motor movement. That may be appropriate and predictive in the case of certain acute injuries, but it wouldn't be appropriate if you're assessing someone, say, with cerebral palsy or an autistic person who has pre-existing and stable challenges with motor movement or speech that have nothing to do with mortality risk. It's an example of the kind of reasonable modification that Arizona incorporated within their CSC. And then next slide, please. Arizona also incorporated protections against providers steering patients into agreeing to the withdrawal or withholding of life-sustaining treatment. And the idea behind this, you know, which the CSC goes into more detail on this topic, it's worth looking at for specific language, is really to ensure that as providers communicate with patients about advanced care planning and end-of-life options, while those communications may become more frequent in the context of shortages, Arizona felt that it was very important to ensure that coercion did not figure into that process and that individuals were not required to consent to a particular advanced care planning decision or make a particular advanced care planning decision in order to continue to receive services. And then finally, Arizona incorporated within their CSC language ensuring that long-term ventilator users would be protected from having a personal ventilator, a ventilator they bring with them into a hospital setting, taken from them to be given to someone else. And this just reflects a concern that we've heard from the public with respect to, or rather that Arizona heard from the public with respect to fear of reallocation of personal ventilators from long-term ventilator users. So Arizona incorporated this protection within their ECR in order to alleviate that concern. Within their CSC in order to alleviate that concern. But thank you. I'll hand things back to Robin Sue now.
Thank you, Ari. I know we're almost at the end and I know some questions came in. So let me just say that, of course, you're well familiar with Tracy. But I want to let you know that we work closely with the Healthcare Resilience Task Force to develop some specific documents that do incorporate the civil rights principles, both in hospitals, long-term care facilities, and also with the national academies in their call to action on crisis standards of care. I also, these slides will definitely be available to everyone on this webinar. And if we go to the next page, I definitely want to encourage each and every one of you to the questions that we don't get to reach out to us individually or collectively and we are happy to follow up and provide technical assistance. And so do we have time for, I guess we just have a couple of minutes. One of the questions that was asked during the registration process that also came up, I saw in the chat box, had to do with how do we engage consumers and stakeholders as we're putting together CSCs and other plans. And I wanted to turn to Molly to just give a few best practices in that area.
Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. Great. Thanks, Robin Sue. And the question that Robin Sue was referring to that was submitted in advance was, how do we get representatives on our CSC committee? And I wanted to thank both the live question and the pre-submitted question asker, because stakeholders, including people with lived experience, including informal support networks, including providers and the broader community, are invaluable to inform this process. And I first want to just emphasize that we are taking a close look at this, and in the toolkit that you'll see referenced in the slides that we are working on developing for communities like you to develop crisis standard of care plans, we're looking at best practices for stakeholder engagement. And that includes community consultations with relevant stakeholders and ensuring representation of communities of color, people with disabilities, older adults, immigrants, people from low-income backgrounds, and other marginalized groups, of course, alongside clinicians and administrators and other providers and relevant healthcare personnel. So that's the baseline, and there'll be more to come. But nitty-gritty, and particularly focusing on people with disabilities and organizations that serve people with disabilities, we would suggest that you start with the existing federally funded entities, such as, and I'll give you a couple on aging area, agencies on aging and aging and disability resource centers. And in the disability space specifically, it's a great idea to start with your protection and advocacy system in your state, which are a network of congressionally mandated, legally based disability rights agencies. A lot of states, they're called disability rights and then the name of the state, but not exclusively. And we can help connect you if you are looking for that information. And there's a number of other federally funded entities that you might want to start connecting with if you're not already, including the Centers for Independent Living in your state, the State Developmental Disability Councils, the University Centers on Excellence in Developmental Disabilities. And finally, because I know I'm taking a lot of time, it may behoove you to look at some of the resources that have been developed around vaccine access and vaccine outreach, because a lot of attention has been paid by the CDC, by the Administration for Community Living, on how to develop systems partnerships collaboratively, and particularly how to do equitable outreach surrounding vaccine access. But a lot of that particular suggestions on how to do it and actually who should be involved is translatable to some of the CSC work. And I know there's a lot more on that, but let me hand it back to Robin Sue. Thank you.
And thank you, Molly. A lot of these resources and partners within HHS are listed on our website. There was one question about what is the disability law during public health emergencies with regard to evacuation and outreach. And just the simple answer to that is that disability law and the non-discrimination principles under the ADA, under Section 504, under 1557, apply to every phase of preparedness, response, and recovery. And outreach, as Molly just talked about, in as you're developing these plans. Again, we are happy to answer any follow-up questions. We are happy if ASPR would like to have us back at some point to talk about some additional issues when there might be more time, and really have appreciated this opportunity to spend some time with you this afternoon. So I think we're right at the 3 o'clock area, and Maria, I'll turn it back to you.
Sounds good. Thanks, Robin, Sue, Molly, and Ari. Really appreciate your time and the discussion. I did want to pass it over to Jennifer to close this out for today.
Thank you, Maria. And I want to thank all of you for taking your time with us today. I want to especially thank our colleagues from the Office for Civil Rights, and we certainly will invite you back to address this particular group, because we know that this crisis standards of care planning is really something that is of particular interest to all of our recipients. So thank you again for participating. Also, thank you to all of our other speakers, Megan and Kate and Lauren as well. And we will, as was stated, we'll make sure that all of these slides are made available to everyone, as well as the recording in a follow-up email. But again, as always, we want to hear from all of you. So if you would like to share how you and your coalitions are using cooperative agreement funding to make an impact on your community, you know, please fill out our story from the field submission form, send a quick note to your project officer, or email hpp@hhs.gov. Please stay in touch with ASPR by visiting our website, www.phe.gov, or by following us on social media at the handles shown on this slide. And with that, I'll say thank you and have a wonderful day. Thanks, everyone.